Welcome to the UFO File Show with your host, Jerry Pippin.
Hello, I'm Jerry Pippin. We're at the Cover Up Cafe, and we're in Roswell, New Mexico, 60 years ago, on either July 3rd or July 4th, according to who you talk to. There was a crash here with extraterrestrials, but this is not the only place things like that have happened. And we have a couple of people here right now who are going to talk about an incident in Mexico. It's an interesting name, No. How did you get that name, No Torres?
Yes, Noe. Noe Torres.
Okay,
yeah,
Noe,
but it's a,
Noe.
It looks like No.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. With the, but the.
And then, there, of course, Ruben Uriarte. Ruben, welcome to the show, too.
Thank you, Jerry. Thanks for the invitation.
And tell us the name of the book and what it's about.
This is a very interesting case. We call the book Mexico's Roswell, the Chihuahua UFO Crash.
And you might tell people where Chihuahua is. We've all heard about it. There's a song about it, an instrumental years ago. And I just started as a disc jockey, and I called it Chihuahua, and they laughed me right out of the station.
So,
Yeah. People have asked us if this is a book about dogs. No, it's not about dogs. Chihuahua is one of the states of Mexico that borders the United States, borders the Texas area, and people are well familiar with the Chihuahuan Desert. So it encompasses the Chihuahuan Desert encompasses the Mexican state of Chihuahua, which is is adjacent to El Paso and the western part of Texas along the Big Bend National Park area of West Texas. So just across the river from there is the Mexican state of Chihuahua.
Now, this book has lots of pictures in it, by the way. So there are evidently a lot of evidence about this thing happening, right?
Yes, we've included over 100 pictures, illustrations, graphs, charts, etc., because we think that this is one of the most important crash retrieval, UFO crash retrieval cases since the 1947 case here in Roswell.
What year did this happen?
This happened in 1974, August 25th. And one thing that we wanted to share is that this is information is based out of a report, a leak, which we feel may have been a leaked military document known as the Deneb Report. And in there, it describes the event where a UFO was being tracked by U.S. radar, and it was going toward the coast of Corpus Christi, going at a speed of about 2,250 miles. It diverted south, made a right angle, went south toward Mexico, then it went toward directly toward the northern area of northern boundaries of border of Mexico, and it collided with an airplane.
What kind of airplane?
Well, in the report, it describes it as a small plane, so we don't have the exact type. But in the in this leads into another scenario where the Mexican military went to retrieve the airplane, and they found the disc object, and all this was being under the surveillance of U.S. military.
So in other words, they just thought it was a plane crash. And even though it might be routine, they were surprised to see the disc, or did radar show it was two things that hit, and they thought they might see people. What do you think was going on there? In other words, were they looking for a flying saucer or another airplane besides the one that crashed with the saucer?
Based on... Go ahead.
The Deneb report indicates that the strange object had been picked up by U.S. military radar at two different locations along the Texas-Mexico border. However, it appears that the Mexicans were only aware of a plane crash having taken place near Coyame, Chihuahua, which is across the border from Presidio, Texas. So the Mexican authorities came out to do what they thought was just an airplane crash. Meanwhile, along the Rio Grande River, along the Texas border, the U.S. military was aware that they had seen on radar two different objects heading toward each other, and then suddenly both objects disappeared off the radar screen.
It sounds to me like you're saying the U.S. military might have thought there was more to it than what the Mexicans did at the time.
I think so, because of the fact that it had been picked up by radar off the coast of Corpus Christi, tracked close to Brownsville, Texas, and then all the way into Mexico.
How is the secret information handled in Mexico? Is it as rough as it is in the United States to get real stories?
That's a real good question. As you know, as it relates to Roswell, 1947, there was at first an immediate announcement by the Army, the Roswell Army Air Force,
yeah.
And then they covered it up, and then you didn't hear much about it until later. There was more information released by this document through the archives, the Eisenhower document that talked about the Roswell crash. Also, it talked about another crash that occurred on the Mexican side of the border. What we're finding out through our research is that there's been a collaboration of between the both governments, both the military, and the book goes into depth about we talked about the missile crisis where German scientists were brought over to White Sands, New Mexico, to test V-2s, right, to get Wernher von Braun, and then of course they start testing V-2s. Well, some of these V-2s steered off course and crashed into the Mexican side of the desert. We had two incidents in 1947. We had another incident that happened in 1967, and another crash that occurred in what's called the Zone of Silence in 1970. So every time there was a missile crash, you had U.S. involvement. Well, there was also a retrieval program called Moondust and Bluefly that involved these retrieval teams to go and recover extraterrestrial craft. So this is where we're trying to tie in all this information together.
You say this incident that you write about happened in 1974?
Yes, the actual date is August 25th, 1974. That is the date given in the Deneb document.
See, immediately the first thing I thought about was 47, summer 74. Of course, it's just coincidence, so there's no connection.
That's an interesting coincidence. Another interesting coincidence is geographically, we're talking about the Chihuahuan Desert, which extends all the way into New Mexico, and also the fact that the crash near Chihuahua, Mexico, happened very close to the Pecos River, which also extends all the way through Roswell, as a matter of fact. So, But another interesting angle of this is
probably no connection.
Yeah, it's just probably coincidental, anecdotal. But the interesting thing is that there seem to be a high number of UFO sightings and paranormal events in the Chihuahuan Desert area, both in northern Mexico and in the southwestern United States. And so that's an interesting angle of
now,
it.
Now, when you both of you found out about this, it was years later, right? Wasn't 1974 when you knew about it, or was it?
No, we got involved in it through just more than about a year and a half ago. Noe had contacted me because the History Channel was doing a number of crash retrieval programs, and they were doing on Mexico Roswell, China's Roswell. Texas Roswell, they were doing all these crash retrieval stories. Mm-hmm. So I was involved in the documentary, and then Noe, who was doing a book at the time, had contacted me and wanted to get more information.
Yeah, were you a researcher, cameraman? What were you doing? The director?
And I was interviewed as one of the UFO experts, or so whatever they call it, but
Noe, when you saw him... on that documentary, you must have said, I have to talk to this guy, huh?
Yes, I was doing a book at that time on Texas UFO sightings, historic Texas UFO sightings, and this was one of the cases I had run across on the internet, but there was very little information about it out there. So I contacted the people who were interviewed for that show, and the response that I got that I felt was really good was Ruben's response. And so we started talking to each other and decided that this was a good enough story to put into book form, at least to get the ball rolling on further investigations and to get perhaps more light shed on this very interesting case that has been more or less ignored.
Do you fellows live close to each other?
No, actually, I live along the Texas-Mexico border in South Texas, and Ruben lives in near Oakland, California.
Up in the Bay Area.
Yeah, that's not exactly next door.
No, not quite, but, you know, with technology, the Internet, and getting on Yahoo Messenger and all that, it's like... Well, sure, right next door.
Over 35% of our audience is somewhere else, Australia, wherever.
Exactly. But something I wanted to share was that I'm the director with MUFON for Northern California, and also I'm the liaison with OMIFO, which is the Mexican UFO organization nationally. So we're developing this relationship and developing a number of contacts with the Mexican investigators throughout the country. So this has been a very big interest to them because, number one, it happened in Mexico. Number two is that this collaboration effort between both countries with researchers, we're starting to uncover more information that may lead, again, to the big cover-up.
Now, what about the Mexican government? Are they subservient to the U.S. on all the secrecy? Or
this is a question that comes up frequently from Mexican UFO researchers. They want to know exactly what the politics might be
like.
Yeah, if
Uncle Sam's calling the shots or not.
Right, and they're very defensive also about the interests and rights of their country.
Sure.
We went back, and historically, as Ruben was saying earlier, we went back in time and looked at previous incidents where the U.S. military was allowed to cross the border to retrieve downed missiles and things like that. And we also know that there were political connections dating back to the 40s and early 50s between the two countries with regard to retrieval incidents like this. Ruben, do you want to add more to that?
Yeah. What we found was back in the 50s, in the early 50s, Miguel Alemán was the president of Mexico, and he very had close communication with Truman, who was the president at that time. Later, Eisenhower became president after Truman had finished his term. But what we found was that there's been communication through other networks that Miguel Alemán was told by Eisenhower that he was taken to a location somewhere in the Southwest where he actually seen the crash retrievals and bodies of extraterrestrials.
So we always hear this story about Eisenhower landing at Edwards and the treaty in 54. This is something else. Eisenhower may have been involved in a lot of things.
Well, we're finding that we're getting information from the actual people that were involved in crash retrievals and also that were involved in military operations or had seen objects and were told to be quiet or they would suffer severe consequences. And this is what we're going into.
Does the Mexican government do the same thing? Do they tell people and threaten them? I mean, it's pretty obvious the U.S. government has.
We haven't gotten that sense.
Ruben, you haven't ran across that yet.
Ruben works with a lot of UFO investigators in Mexico, and that's not the case as much as it is here in the U.S.
Yeah. What's interesting, though, is that some of these historical cases, are the good old men in black come up again. Uh-huh. And you find that the men in black have threatened certain individuals to keep quiet. We had in our book research of a pilot, Carlos de los Santos. 8 months later, he was flying a small airplane going back toward Mexico City. And then all of a sudden he felt like he was being watched. He looked to his left. There was a small disc right above his wing. He looked over to his right. There was another small disc. Then all of a sudden, he's looking in front of his canopy, and this object came and slammed right underneath his fuselage. It had control of his airplane for 18 minutes. He's calling, "Mayday, mayday, mayday," and air traffic controllers in Mexico City were seeing these objects in his airplane. I've got the actual recordings of him calling, "Mayday, mayday, mayday."
Nobody answered?
They were trying to calm him down.
Oh, okay,
and,
okay.
They raised his airplane from 10,000 feet up to 14,000 feet. His plane was not pressurized. And then all of a sudden, they let him go. The plane, he was able to retrieve back. But he had the crash underneath the fuselage. So
when he did have some physical evidence,
exactly,
that something happened up there.
Well, then later, he was met by J. Allen Hynek and some other notable researchers. And then there was these individuals that were dressed in black. They told them, you need to be quiet or else. They threatened them. And that was one instance, and there's been a number of others. So it's almost the same kind of a scenario that we've been getting.
It's very interesting that movies and fiction writers seem to have a lot of this that comes out in real life. Have you noticed that?
That's absolutely correct. We're right now working on a case. There's a retired U.S. Air Force colonel who lives in North Texas who is telling a remarkable story about visiting the site of a UFO crash retrieval. He's 81 years old, and he's finally decided to come forward with his story. But even though he's 81 and his military career is long over, he was so he received so many threatening phone calls and messages from his former superiors and other people in the military that even now, so many years, he left the military in the middle 60s, he still feels very uncomfortable talking. And it's only now after so many years that he has decided to come forward with the full details of his story.
Why do you think the government is so ambitious in guarding these secrets about this?
You know, we may have to go back to what Stanton Friedman used to share at the conference. The country that controls the technology controls the world.
And it could
who knows that that's part of the reason why they're doing the retrievals, right. You know, for the technology reasons. But also some of the issues that have come up. We talked about the Mexican convoy that went out to recover that craft. When they went out to discover the wreckage of the airplane, they also discovered the disc. Well, what happened was that all these soldiers died.
I want to follow that up. We've got to take a break, and we'll come back. We'll also go to the audience if they have some questions, because I wanted to ask you about the ramifications of the crash retrieval itself and whether or not there was any evidence of inhabitants on any of on that craft. Our guest, of course, Noe Torres and Ruben Urante, and it's interesting that the the Chihuahua UFO crash is just now coming to light, and there seems to be a lot of things about this thing that we need to find out about. I'm Jerry Pippin. You're listening to the UFO Files. We're broadcasting from Roswell, New Mexico. The biggest secret ever is about to be revealed. Fast Walkers, UFO and Alien Disclosure.
Words you were never meant to hear.
It's clear we're dealing with a cosmic Watergate.
This is the biggest secret in the history of the human race, the known modern history of government.
Photos you were never meant to see. Video you never knew existed. People you were never meant to meet.
As Jack Nicholson would say, you can't handle the truth.
Essentially everything that you would want to know has been covered up.
Things you were never meant to know about.
No one has produced a higher quality, better produced DVD. Anytime, anywhere. Fast Walkers, now available on DVD for only $19.95 at shopjerrypippin.com. Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin. We're broadcasting from the UFO Files second headquarters, I guess, right down the street from the UFO Museum in Roswell, New Mexico. We've been involved with these folks for some time. It's always a pleasure to come back to Roswell. And our guest, really a phenomenal book. They cover this one crash, but there's other things in the book. I saw something from 1908 or something that you wrote about. So you did a lot of research, for sure. Noe Torres and Ruben Urante, and this book is available, correct? You can probably get it at Amazon. We have a link to get it too.
Yes, by profession, I'm a librarian and have always been interested in doing research. I've written several books that have to do with history and involved looking up a lot of information in historical archives, libraries, and things like that. So Ruben and I spent a lot of time doing the grunt work to put together the evidence for this story. And not only that, but we went out to the Chihuahuan Desert, to Coyame, where this happened. We talked to villagers there, and we were determined before we published our book to have as much information of the little information that's out there about this crash retrieval. We wanted to get as much of it as we could, documented and evidence.
One of the people here in the restaurant asked if you'd gone out to this site personally, and you have.
Yes, we spent a week in January of this year in Coyame. We had, before we went there, we had done about a year's worth of contacting folks by phone and email who live in the area. And one of our biggest assets for information in that area is a local attorney. He's an attorney in Chihuahua, the capital of the state, Chihuahua City, but he's a big landowner in Coyame, and he owns two big ranches that are just adjacent to where this object is believed to have crashed. So he gave us a lot of information about the strange things that he's seen on his property. There have been landing marks, and Ruben can talk about some of the other things. But he and other people that we contacted ahead of time paved the way for us going down there and putting all this evidence together.
When you said strange things, I was wondering, and one of our members of the audience wanted to know, any paranormal activity down there that you detected?
We also had the opportunity to go to what's called the Zone of Silence. I went in October.
Tell me about that.
It's an area that supposedly... an area where located south of Chihuahua and Coahuila, where radio signals cannot be cannot reach. There's a high magnetism area. It's been an area where there's been a report of a lot of UFOs. When we went there, we interviewed some people that live out there in these small ranches. They very much keep information to themselves. You have to really gain their trust, and one of the questions, and also they don't want to appear, they're very humble, very open, honest people, but they're not looking for sensationalism or attention.
Let's talk about the crash itself for a minute. Any evidence of for lack of a better term, extraterrestrial EBEs or whatever you want to call them?
The Denham report, upon which most of our book is based, along with the field investigation that we did and the library research, the Denham report itself does not mention that there were any bodies recovered other than any extraterrestrial bodies, EBEs, but we ran across an interesting story from a longtime UFO researcher, Robert Dean, who worked with us.
I know Bob.
Right. Bob worked with us on part of this book, and he told us this incredible tale, which we've included in one of the chapters, where he was in Mexico City about 5 years after the Coyame crash incident, and he was approached by a Mexican policeman who told him that he indicated he wanted to talk to him, and the policeman pulled out of his wallet a picture of what looks like a gray alien. And he said that this alien, the body of this alien, had been recovered along the Texas-Mexican border in the crash of a UFO. And Bob has the feeling that this may have been associated with the Coyame crash, although we don't know for sure. And there's been a number of reported UFO crash retrievals along the Texas-Mexico border. But because of the time frame in which it happened, which Bob was given the picture in Mexico City and about 5 years after Coyame incident, there could be a link.
When we talk about these incidents in another country like Mexico, which is next door to the United States, and a lot of things involving UFOs happened in the southwestern United States, what do you make of that? Is this... I know, for instance, that we do sightings on the radio every week or two, and there's no shortage of people seeing things everywhere. But there always seems to be like there was a lot of activity in this part of the world. You know what I mean?
Yeah, we were really curious about why there's so many reports of sightings, and One of the things that we've found, of course, is the trajectory of that particular object back in 1974 flew over a very remote area. And what we're finding as of today is that whole stretch is very remote, not populated or sparsely populated. And here's the thing, that here you have a sparsely populated border next to the biggest military nation in the world, and how ideal would it be for these objects to fly in and out of an area where they're not going to be threatened, because Mexico does not have the military, doesn't have the Air Force to shoot these things down.
Well, there have been, a lot of things officially from Mexico, like I'm thinking of the infrared thing with the Mexican Air Force and things like that. They seem to be a little more open to reporting at least part of it.
That happened March of 2004, and I had the privilege of going with two other scientists, Dr. Richard Haynes from NARCAP and Ted Rowe, who was the executive officer for NARCAP, and myself. I went with them, and this was before the Mexican military was had allowed Mr. Jaime Maussan to release this footage. When we went down there, this is where we interviewed Mr. Carlos de los Santos. We met air traffic controllers, other pilots that had been talking about and having experiences with objects flying over the Mexican City Airport and other airports. And, of course, the focus was on air safety, because these objects are flying close to airliners, commercial airliners, not just in Mexico, but all over the world.
Sure.
But the fact that the military was so interested, because here you had highly trained, qualified, that were taught, trained by U.S. to fly this this airplane to record, and yet they've came across these strange objects. And Mr. Maussan, who does a lot of investigations, and he's a highly notable journalist, they gave him that information to share to the world.
Yeah, when we talk about UFO crashes, we almost in the same sentence we're talking about superior technology, but they still have accidents. I wonder what causes that. You have any ideas about why we have so many crashes?
Well,
they're not many, but you go to the crash retrieval conference in Las Vegas, and there's quite a few they bring up.
Of course, a lot of what we do is speculate on the possible causes of these crashes. However, one thing that's made an impact in my mind when I've read about crash retrievals is that we're dealing with beings who are mortal, who are, although they may have superior technology, we don't know exactly what that technology is. However, they are mortal, and they are capable of error, and it's possible that for whatever unforeseen circumstances these crashes occur, that because of the evidence indicates that they do, so therefore it's something that apparently has happened for various reasons.
You think there's any chance there might be intervention by the U.S., even though it seems like we're behind in technology, but maybe not as far as we think?
You know what's interesting, Jerry? I came across a document that was from the FBI when Hoover was involved in the FBI was very much interested in UFO and crash retrievals as well. And in that document, it stated that they had notified a military resource within the Air Force that said that they believed that at that time in the early 50s, they had these very high powerful radars that was...
That's been a theory here in Roswell.
Well, that's where it came, this is what I saw within the document. Now, that happened in the 50s because we had a whole string of other crashes, and of course, as you know, the lightning strike theory.
Right. That radar in 47 was not the same radar you see on Channel 5.
Right.
For weather. I still wonder, with all the crash retrievals, that means somebody somewhere in some warehouse has some material. Looks like somebody would talk sometime.
That's an interesting point. One of the things that's been one of the theories that's been advanced that I happen to agree with is that if superior technology is found and we're not capable of doing anything with it right away because we have nothing that is analogous to it, and therefore, you know, we can try to reverse engineer it and we might be able to find some corollary uses for some of that technology, but the core of it is going to remain inaccessible to us until our own technology gets up to a higher level. So therefore, packing this away and storing it for continuous study long term would be the solution that's indicated here, because it would only be after many years of careful study and research and allowing our own technology to get closer to this one that has been retrieved, only then would we be able to, you know, actually use some of it.
Just to go along with that, I heard this analogy. It's just like having a large nuclear submarine taken back to the 17th century. You think people would learn how to reverse engineer a nuclear submarine. So we may be that 17th century dealing
right,
with some
right, trying events. To figure this out.
Yeah.
And, I imagine they'd be scratching their head quite a lot. Where's the sale? what do you got planned next, guys?
We have a very interesting crash retrieval that also occurred along the Texas-Mexico border. It may, in fact, be mentioned in the Eisenhower briefing document. There is a mention of a crash retrieval along the Del Rio, Texas area, Texas-Mexico border in 1950. We have a gentleman who is retired U.S. Air Force colonel I mentioned earlier who is stepping forward with an incredible story about having actually visited the site where he saw a metallic disc-shaped object impacted into the side of a sand dune right along the Rio Grande River near Del Rio, Texas. So we've been interviewing him extensively. We went to visit him at his home in North Texas, and he's ready after all these years, after being out of the military since the middle 60s, he's ready now to tell give full details about his story, which is a fascinating one.
How big a craft was this particular one in Chihuahua? Do we know? The craft itself, the crash?
Well, it was a small disc.
Small disc, which is in
16 feet. It was
16
feet, 5 inches in diameter. And it was almost identical to the three UFOs that Ruben was mentioning approached and circled the plane over that was flying to Mexico City with the pilot that 8 months later.
It's an incredible read, and we recommend it to everyone. Mexico's Roswell, and they came to the United States as Roswell to promote the book and do a little investigating, I imagine. It's
yes.
The first time for you guys here?
Oh, here to Roswell?
Yeah.
Oh, this is my second time.
Okay.
Yes.
How about you?
This is my first time, although I've intended to come on many occasions. I'm very happy to be here.
Now, you still work at the library?
Yes, sir. I'm a librarian.
And do they know your interest in UFOs?
Actually, I've built up the UFO section of our library quite extensively.
UFO publishers love you.
Yes.
So the students. Now, where is this library?
This is in South Texas, in McAllen.
McAllen, Texas.
Yes,
uh-huh. Okay. We appreciate you guys coming by. Noe Torres and Ruben Llorente, and you're probably going to be making the rounds with some other places since you're into this hot and heavy now, right, guys?
Yes.
Correct. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank
Let's
you
give them a hand.
The opportunity,
Thank you, Jerry.
Okay, and the book is available, and we have a link to it. I'm Jerry Pippin. You're listening to the UFO Files. We're broadcasting from Roswell, New Mexico. I would like to take this opportunity to talk to you about a vacation idea for this summer, or really any time, that is unique, different, and affordable. I'm talking about a tour of the Grand Canyon in a van with Marvelous Marv, the world-famous tour guide. Marvelous Marv has lived in the Grand Canyon area for well over 2 decades, and he will show you things that no other tour guide will, and all the while fill you in on the history and the mystery of the giant canyon itself. When you go on a tour with Marv, you get to see the best viewpoints and the best exhibits. He knows this canyon. He knows this area of Arizona. Now, on this page, there's a banner you can click on, and will take you to Marv's website, where you can get all the answers about Marv and his Grand Canyon tour. This is a vacation you will treasure forever. Check it out, won't you? Marvelous Marv's Grand Canyon Tour. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the show from the Cover Up Cafe. I'm Jerry Pippin. We're right down the street from the UFO Museum. People come here from all over the world, and man, I've interviewed several times. From England is with me now, Philip Mantle. And Philip, it's a pleasure finally to meet you in person.
And the pleasure's all mine, Jerry.
You had this alien autopsy inquiry book. Tell me a little bit about that, first of all. I know you're pretty prolific. You got a lot of things going on.
Well, I mean, I've been involved with the so-called alien autopsy film since its inception, and was the first UFO researcher contacted by its owner, Ray Santilli, way back in 1993. So,
tell me a little bit about that. A lot of people, you know, it was the talk of the industry for a while. Then everybody said, well, it may not be what it's supposed to be.
So, well, I mean,
yeah, tell me a little bit about it.
Well, Santilli contacted me in 1993. He said, I've got this film. So it took about 1.5 years before we saw any film. And I was also a conference organizer, and I asked him to show it, and he did. And we let slip to a journalist friend of mine prior to that, and the story got out.
Uh-huh.
And it literally went around the world overnight. And my telephone never stopped ringing for weeks on end. And of course, here in the United States, the film ended up on Fox, Alien Autopsy,
yes.
Fact or Fiction, which was a huge success. It's highly controversial, as you would imagine, you know, the autopsy of an alleged alien being. Its owner, Ray Santilli, has changed his story on a number of occasions, but he still maintains that in Cleveland, Ohio, in 1993, when he was there, looking for vintage film of Elvis and so on, he met a former military cameraman and bought the film from him. And he stands by that story to this very day. I had lunch with him just recently, and he still says the same story.
Well, you've had a relationship with him on and off. You've known the man for a while and talked to him. You believe him?
I wouldn't say I believe him. The way I look at it from a research point of view was to try and get to the bottom of the film. You know, belief really doesn't come into it. You know, Ray tells a story. And myself and colleagues in different parts of the world, not just England, not just America, but in various parts of the world, have tried to get to the bottom of it. And the results so far are the book Alien Autopsy Inquest. A few years ago, I was seriously ill, and as part of my rehabilitation, I thought, well, I've got all these files, all this research, I'll try and do something with it. And I started writing the book after I came out of hospital. And the book itself is dedicated to the staff at the hospital. And managed to get it published just this year, just March of 2007. And the reason the word inquest is in it, it's like any inquest over someone who dies under mysterious circumstances. All the evidence that we've come up with is there in the book, but it allows the reader to come to their own conclusion. We give them four possibilities of what the film may be. It could be real. It could be a hoax made for money. Could be some poor deformed human creature. Could be some kind of military propaganda film. Those are the four hypotheses that we work with. But you read the evidence and decide for yourself, you know, which makes the most sense to you.
Okay, if we take those same standards and the same questions, you're here in Roswell, what do you make of the 47 crash incident?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's unequivocal that something quite bizarre took place there. Clearly it wasn't a weather balloon, quite clearly.
Right.
But an interesting point is that when the Santilli alien autopsy film came out in 1995, prior to that, the United States Air Force had always maintained there were no bodies at Roswell because it was a balloon, be it an ordinary balloon or Project Mogul. After this film came out, the United States Air Force, for the first time ever, admitted that bodies were at Roswell. Okay, they said they were crash test dummies or whatever, but that's the kind of influence this film had on it. And I don't buy the crash test dummy thing anyway. I've seen one. I'm pretty sure if you found one in the desert, you'd know what it was.
Yeah, you know? I agree with you.
But I've just read Don Schmidt and Carey's latest book, and it's absolutely riveting.
Yes, it is.
Absolutely riveting.
You can take the evidence in that book and go to any criminal court and win a circumstantial
absolutely.
Case.
Absolutely. And not only that, I've met prior to this, prior to coming to Roswell, I've met, fortunate enough to meet Jesse Marcel Jr. on several occasions, and you couldn't meet a more honest man. You really couldn't. And at the end of the day, he said, you know, this is what my father told me, this is what I saw. and it wasn't a weather balloon. End of story.
Now, Philip, what are you doing here in Roswell? Just hanging out and doing a little reporting? Are you making a
Doing a number of things. I've got friends who live in Albuquerque, so they invited me over.
Okay.
I thought towards the end of the year. I mean, I'm come from England. I'm not used to all this sunshine you've got. So right. I thought if we come November time, it'd be a lot cooler.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't get so burnt. But he said, no, I want you to come now. We're going to drive down through the desert in Socorro. We'll have a look at the various crash sites and we'll take in the Roswell Festival while we're there. So this was all done at short notice. So I contacted Julie at the museum and said, is it possible to be added to the speakers list? And she said, yes. You won't see my name on any of the published literature, but I did a presentation this afternoon and another one tomorrow at 9:30. So I'm just happy to be here.
Now, when we talk about your sojourn from Albuquerque to Roswell, have you seen other interesting things? Have you been out to the crash site or anything yet?
Well, one of the colleagues I work with, he used to live in Albuquerque. His name is Ed Gurman. And one of the things about the alien autopsy film, we received information supposedly from the original cameraman as where the incident happened in the desert. And Ed took it upon himself to try and find this location. Others had tried and failed, but Ed was familiar with the terrain. He'd lived and worked in this area for many years, and he believes he found this particular area. So we visited that yesterday. It's way off the beaten track. I could never find it in 1,000 years. You have to have a 4x4 to get there, and there is a number of anomalies just in that one area. There's burnt trees just there. There's burnt rocks that are only burnt on one side. And there's a strange bluish material on the rock face called cristobalite, but it's only there in that one particular area. We drove further down this canyon and you can't find it anywhere else. Ed's convinced this is the correct area. I can't say it is, I can't say it isn't. All I will say is it's extremely peculiar. I've got some samples of this material that I'm going to take back to England with me in my suitcase and see if I can have it analysed in the UK to replicate the findings that Ed's come up with.
Well, you will have to stay in touch on that for sure.
Well, I will. I mean, I work for a magazine in the UK.
Oh, you're right. It's a great magazine. I was going to get around to plugging that here in a moment. Tell our listeners about it.
The magazine's called UFO Data. It's self-funded. We don't have a backer or a publisher or financer. Mm-hmm. So the findings will be in there. Not only that, I'm going to do a small piece about the festival this weekend, you know, what's been happening, a few photographs, just to let people know that, you know, if you get the chance, come on down.
Well, that's good. You know, your magazine, Larry Dickin, our executive producer, looks at it, and he was really impressed with it.
Well, again, you know, there used to be a magazine produced by a colleague of mine called Graham Birdsall.
Yeah, I knew him.
The magazine was called UFO Magazine.
Right.
Sadly, Graham died all of a sudden in 1993.
Right.
And the magazine closed with him. The editor of our magazine is Russell Callahan, which is Graham's son-in-law. I've known Graham, I knew him since the late 1970s. And we wanted to, you know, start off where Graham finished, if you like, where he ended. So we started last year and started the magazine.
Is it a bi-monthly?
It's bi-monthly. It's only available on subscription. It's just UFO Data. You can subscribe online. It's not a problem.
And we have a link to that.
It's
Philip Mantle page and on the Roswell page.
Yeah, so we're very pleased. We're trying to increase its circulation because I'm not married anymore, but if I had a wife, she'd be frightened about how much money we put into it ourselves. So,
well, it may be lucky for the magazine aficionados. You're not married. You were able to do it right.
Well, we're very pleased with the magazine. I mean, it seems, Jerry, that wherever we send a copy, we always get, you know, very positive feedback. A lot of people seem to like it. It's just a question of getting people to know that it's actually there. Because we cover things not just from England, but from around the world. So it's not just an English magazine.
Now, Philip, when we talked, I think, last month or the month before, you said you were going to have something come out in June, another book, right?
Well, it was this one, the Alien Autopsy Inquest. It came out in March, officially, but it's now available. You can get it on Amazon, and I'm extremely pleased with it. Again, we've only just sent out the first review copies, and the feedback's been extremely positive.
Now, what's your next project? You've covered the gamut in the investigations here.
Well, the next project is literally, I'm trying to finish that before I came out here, but I've not managed to do that. I've also worked with a colleague of mine called Paul Stonehill,
I know Paul very well.
Yeah, Paul's originally from the Ukraine.
Right.
Last year, Paul and I did a book together called Mysterious Sky, all about UFOs behind the Iron Curtain. Well, just recently, I took part in a documentary for a television company in Moscow, and they've supplied me with a transcript of an interview with the former deputy commander of the KGB. His name was Nikolai Sham, and he talks about the official Soviet investigation into UFOs that ran from 1987 to 1991. We know the story, but we'd never actually got an interview with this particular gentleman before. So when I get back home, I'm going to finish that transcripted interview, and that'll be published shortly. And it's absolutely riveting, because not only does he talk about UFO sightings, he also talks about the way the Soviets broke the various arms treaties by launching missiles and rockets, and they actually disguised them as UFO sightings as well. So it's fascinating in both areas.
Yeah, you're right.
And this is the deputy commander of the KGB. It's not some clerk in an office. He was the second in command. And it's absolutely fascinating. It really is.
We're talking with Philip Mantle. We're here at the really the world famous, I guess we could say, Cover-Up Cafe now. And it's right down the street from the UFO Museum. And we'll be right back in a moment to talk to Philip again. I'm Jerry Pippin. Don't go away.
Hello, this is Farah Yurduze. Maybe you have questions about love, your job, your health, money and more. With my psychic gifts and my tarot readings, we can reveal the solutions to your deepest mysteries. Please visit me through Jerry Pippin Radio and let's find the answers together.
Click on Farah's banner for the answers to the most personal question. It's Jerry Pippin, and we're broadcasting from the Cover-Up Cafe. And your name?
Suzanne Stockton.
Where are you from?
Georgia, originally.
Okay, and well, I can tell that.
Okay.
Yeah. A Southern Belle here. So you live in Roswell now?
No, Ruidoso.
Okay, so Odessa's not all that close.
Ruidoso.
Okay, Ruidoso, gotcha. Well, that Georgia accent got
me.
Down to the horse races.
No, we live there.
Okay. Okay. No, I knew that, but I meant that's Ruidoso.
Yes.
Downs is
yes.
Famous for it. Now, you had a question for Philip Mantle.
What about Rendlesham Forest?
Well, Rendlesham Forest is probably the most famous UFO incident in Britain. It actually took place just off base of RAF Woodbridge. Although it was a Royal Air Force base, it was an American military base. For those that are not aware, in December, late December of 1980, an object landed in the Rendlesham Forest, was seen by base personnel. The following night was another incident, so Deputy Commander Lieutenant Colonel Holt took a band of men into the forest. I chased this thing through the trees. I've met Colonel Holt, and he tells you about these almost like laser beams, pencil thin beams of light coming down from the sky. Not at an angle, these were coming straight down. And there's a lot more to the story than that, but Colonel Holt wrote a memo about this. It was sent to the Ministry of Defence and to his bosses back in the US, and it more or less died a death, but it was released here under the Freedom of Information Act. But for years the Ministry of Defence in England had denied they had any documentation on it at all, so we managed to force them into the open. There were marks on the ground where this thing was there. It's a kind of a three dots in a triangle. Because it was on public land, The Air Force had to call the police, the local constabulary. And the police came out. By the time they got there, it was gone. Because this is in Suffolk. It's quite a rural area. So that on an evening, on a night, there's only two or three police officers on duty. And they came, looked, you know, it was just the Americans. Yeah. But they'd got a burglary to go to, so they had to go. But in their official police log, of which I have a copy, it is there, and it says UFO. And since that time, of course, many of the military personnel that were there have gone on the record and have described this strange craft with insignia and the events that happened. And it is the most documented and well-documented case in Britain. It's absolutely fascinating. And, of course, Woodbridge, although we didn't know it at the time, was a nuclear facility. Nuclear missiles were stored there. Colonel Holt will talk about the UFOs he saw, but he will not talk about the nuclear missiles.
Interesting. Thank you very much. You know, talking about the Freedom of Information Act, you have something over in England now akin to that. It's newer, right?
Absolutely.
How is it working?
Well, the Labour government promised in their manifesto they would bring in a Freedom of Information Act, which they did, and that came out pretty much last year. So, on the Ministry of Defence website, the one piece of information that is requested more than anything else is UFOs. So, to circumvent this, the Ministry of Defence have decided to publish all their files, make them all freely available. So it will save them time and money. And some fascinating material is now starting to emerge.
Now, this website that they're putting up, is that the way they're going to release it?
It's there on the Ministry of Defence website.
Oh, okay.
You can go there, you can submit a Freedom of Information Act request. If the documents are all, we don't have the National Archives.
Do they black it out like...
Only person's names. Only person's names, nothing else. We've got the archives in queue. You can go to the archives and view the documents, make copies, and while you're there, with pleasure. There's a number of researchers who've been active in this, a chap called Dr. David Clark, to give him his correct pronunciation. He's a historian, but he's a UFO researcher as well, has a PhD in folklore. And David has diligently worked with the authorities to try and get this to happen. And he's a sceptical gentleman, you know, but the documents are there for all to see. And more will come out in the next few years, Jerry, without a doubt.
So in other words, Philip, your freedom of information movement has not been corrupted like it has been here.
Well, no, because it's only relatively new.
They haven't figured out the angles yet.
Not yet. But, we have the Official Secrets Act, which is all-encompassing. And it's grossly outdated. It was brought in for the First World War. And I was just discussing...
That's a 50-year deal, right? Supposedly an Official Secrets Act?
No, it's for life.
Oh, is it?
It's for life. I mean, a friend of mine signed the Official Secrets Act, but he works in a textile mill. And the only reason he had to say it, because they made cloth for military uniforms. But he had to sign the Official Secrets Act. Another friend of mine, he worked for the Ministry of Defence as a clerk, but he still had to sign the act. So it's all, it covers everything. It's even an Official Secrets of how many tea bags they use in the Houses of Parliament.
It's glad to see the bureaucracy alive and well there, as well as here and other places in the world. You've done research all around the world. How about your research behind the Iron Curtain, the old Iron Curtain? Because your work with Paul Stonehill is very interesting.
Well, this started in the late 1980s when there was a very large event at Voronezh in the Soviet Union, and for some reason. I was interviewed by a lot of the media from Russia, and I gave them my comments, and we then started receiving letters and books and magazines from the Soviet Union, from Russia. Of course, most of it I couldn't read. It was all in Russian.
Right.
And I knew Paul, so we shared some of this information, and it just kept on coming, you know. So we also, you know, made contact with a lot more of the researchers. Then, of course, there was Perestroika and the fall of the Soviet Empire, which allowed freedom of exchange of information.
In fact, that was kind of the angle of my question, how did Glasnost work?
Well, it worked fine. But the biggest barrier after that was the language barrier. And the cost, I mean, you know, the Soviet Union was almost bankrupt. So the researchers had information, but they couldn't even afford the postage to send it. But, you know, slowly but surely the economy changed, and we've managed to break down a lot of the barriers. And Paul and I decided it's about time we published this material, to show that the UFO phenomenon is truly global. And we also, in the book, pay tribute to the researchers in Russia, or I should say in the Soviet Union, or the former Soviet Union, because there was a time in the Soviet Union that you could lose your life, quite literally, for being involved in this subject. It was a banned subject.
So, really?
Absolutely. You could lose your life for being involved in this subject.
I had heard that Stalin was aware of Roswell fairly quickly.
Absolutely. He was aware of Roswell, and he wanted to know what was going on. Mm-hmm. But in latter years, it was, you know, you were under the threat of death if you were involved in this subject. As simple as that. And nobody in the United States or in England or in Western Europe has ever had to face that threat. So we also pay tribute to these researchers, because they didn't give in. There was an underground movement that carried on researching, you know, they carried on exchanging information behind the scenes under such severe punishment. And it's tribute to their work. It really is.
Penalty's pretty much...
Absolutely. You know, there's no court. You know, there was no going to court. There was no fines or, you know, imprisonment.
Right.
It could quite literally have, you know, you could have lost your life over it. So it's all tribute to them. It really is.
Anything unique about their UFO investigations and sightings?
The one thing I mentioned briefly was the KGB. Now, in 1987, there was a huge sighting on the border between Russia and China, and it interfered with the telecommunications. Basically, the telecommunications were out. It sent a shockwave through the Soviet regime. You know, whatever this phenomena was, it's just cut off all our communications. You know, if this was an attack by the Chinese, mm-hmm. we're up the creek. So they launched an official investigation that the Western world knew nothing about. Now, every member of the Soviet military was involved, every single one. At that time, that was 4 million people. And they conducted an official investigation from 1987 to 1991. You imagine having 4 million people involved in an official investigation? They all reported to the Academy of Sciences in Moscow. And in 1991, the Deputy Commander, Nikolai Sham, released some of the information. It's called the KGB files, for want of a better word.
Mm-hmm.
He released it to former astronaut Pavel Popovich, whose wife, Marina, was a UFO researcher, and then the information got out to the West. It's only the tip of the iceberg. There is a lot more to it, but it showed exactly how methodical they went and did the interviews with the witnesses, you know, official interviews, mm-hmm. and the transcripts, and the pilots. It's all there.
When we talk to people here about incidents involving SAC and UFOs coming over and us going on alert and going toward Russia, and Russia thinks that it's us and we think it's them, did you see any evidence of anything like that happening?
Not necessarily. They were extremely frightened by a number of the incidents, mm-hmm. not just the one on the Chinese border,
uh-huh.
because some of the incidents did take place near military installations, and that's why they began it, because they were terrified of what these things were. You know, they had no preconceived ideas, but if you can imagine, there's a phenomena there that takes out your communications, you're dead in the water.
You also, I know Stonehill is quite fascinated with what it's called, submersible UFOs underwater.
Absolutely. I mean, again, in the information that's come forward, you know, because Russia is it's the biggest country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has a lot of borders, but a lot of sea as well. And there was a number of incidents that were reported of unidentified objects, but rather than in the sky, they were underneath the sea instead. And it's an area of the subject that doesn't get much exposure. You know, it's largely ignored, but it's nonetheless fascinating. And we cover this in the book.
When we talk to you, Philip, you've done so many interesting things on this subject. We bounce around a little bit. Our time's almost up, so we need to get back to the reason you're here in Roswell. Among other things, you have friends, and it was a good time to come down because it's the 60th anniversary, and the A&E autopsy inquest came out. We talked to you on the phone about that from England,
mm-hmm.
but here in person we're talking about. What? Tell me a little bit about this book. What are we going to find in here?
Well, the book starts from the very beginning of Ray Santillani's story, and about who saw what, because a lot of people are unaware that there's actually two autopsy films, not just the one.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's two. I've seen them both. For whatever reason, one's never been released, although...
Made by the same guy.
Yeah. Myself and a number of colleagues have seen it, so we start off with that, just verifying exactly what is there. Ray tells his story. So then we look at the film. How do you investigate a film like this? So we try to look at the film from every different angle. We get the film experts in to have a look at it. Because it's a medical procedure, Jerry, we showed it to medical professionals around the world. A large proportion of us were pretty impressed with it. They won't comment as to what the creature may be, but they commented on the medical procedure, the instruments that we use and that kind of thing. We went to the museums, checked out the things you see on the film. They were all circa 1947. We checked with it, special effects experts. Nearly all think that they can recreate it, which I'm sure they can. We even spoke to abductees who claimed to have seen something similar themselves, and there's a number of people in the book from Britain and the UK who claim to have seen the film many years before Ray Santilli's ownership, because remember, the cameraman said these were just a few scrap reels basically that he'd kept behind. The remainder of the film was the bulk of it was sent to Washington. So we thought, well, if this is a real incident, has someone else seen it before this, you know, in a military briefing or wherever? And a number of people did come forward and said, yes, you know, I saw that in 1955, 65, whatever. So that's absolutely fascinating.
And the fascinating part to me is that we are in a position in the world that we refine almost everything out of existence. We overanalyze it, go on and on and on. And almost anything, it can be as true can be. But if you get enough questions about it, and people don't believe you.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I'm not asking people, with this book, I'm not asking people to believe anything. Just read it and make up your own mind. You know, I don't know all the answers, and I'd be a big head if I thought I did. Just read it and come to your own conclusion.
That's a technique that I found even in the Hart memo, and the affidavit that came out recently. The government back in 1947 was using redirection. Well, they know about this debris site. Let's get the attention on that. That's the way the government works.
Absolutely. Of course it is.
The way all of us work.
Yeah,
really.
And they still do it to this very day. Yeah, right. It's an old trick that still works.
Right, right. Now Philip, how long have you been in the States?
I'm going home on Wednesday. Next Wednesday, so I'll go back to Albuquerque on Monday, then home on Wednesday.
Okay, we will. Have you been doing any Turkish investigations? There's a lot of Turkey.
No, but I did know one researcher in Turkey, but again, the language barrier is sometimes a bit of a problem.
Right, right.
But, you know, it's great to be here because there's people here from all over the
world. Oh, I met somebody from Iran who was talking to me. I couldn't hear a lot of what they were saying.
But again, Jerry, what it does emphasize is that whatever UFOs may or may not be, they don't know any international boundaries or borders. It is truly an international phenomenon.
It's pretty close to the same story, really.
Absolutely. And you know, it's just a joy to be here in Roswell. It's almost the mecca of UFOs, for want of a better phrase. Don't wish to offend anybody.
This is one place that you can actually talk about it with a straight face.
Yeah.
And
somebody told me,
actually changing though around the world, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, somebody said to me, "What are you going to Roswell for, Philip? It's a circus." Well, I'd have to disagree. I haven't found it to be a circus at all.
Yeah, we were discussing that earlier.
The people I've spoken to seem to know an awful lot about the subject. They care about the subject. They're passionate about it. Certainly not a circus. It's been extremely enjoyable. I've met some old friends. And I've made some new ones. I've tried some chili. It burnt my mouth.
Yeah, I agree with you. Like green chili in New Mexico.
It was
don't
green.
Touch it.
It was green.
Right.
You know. But my friend,
spoon bends.
My friend Ed insisted. All he's talked about is chili for 3 days. So I thought, but when I get to Roswell, I'll try some. Didn't want to eat any while I was on the road in the car, but it was great.
Years ago, Roberta and I were on the road up in Santa Fe, and they said, "You have to try this green chili." Well, I wasn't expecting what I got.
Yeah.
It is hot.
Absolutely. I know exactly what you mean. But it was great when we stopped to a small town called, excuse the pronunciation, Carrizozo, on the way down.
It beats me.
Yeah, Carrizozo. And then
Riadosa says it's right.
Yeah, we stayed in. We had some food in a small cowboy bar, and it was absolutely terrific. I thought only those places existed in the movies, you know. But I'm glad to know they don't. I thought it was absolutely terrific, and the scenery is absolutely breathtaking. It really is. I mean, you know, I come from England. It's a little country. Everybody's all crammed together. We have some beautiful places. But we forget, coming on from a small island, just how big America is. I mean, every time I get out of the car, I've got to change the time on my watch. I mean, I can't get used to that at all, you know.
Yeah, do you have two time zones in England?
No.
What? Just the one?
Just the one, Greenwich.
GMT.
GMT, that's it.
Okay.
That's enough. Thank
okay.
you.
I know when we were getting together for the interview, we're in Central Time, and Larry's in Eastern Time, and we wanted to make sure we had the right time to call you, and I think I missed it by an hour and had to call you back.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Philip Mantle, thank you very much for being with us. AN Autopsy Inquest is the name of the book. It's available, and we have a link on our website. Let's give Philip a big hand.
My pleasure, Jerry. Thank you.
And until next time, I'd like to thank Roberta Scott, our location producer, Jane Swartley, our editor. Cheers.
Oh, The year was 1970 when Jack Blanchard and Misty Morgan released their first big single hit, Tennessee Birdwalk. For the first time in the history of music, this 45 RPM single becomes available to the public in the form of a mouse pad. Made of high-quality quarter-inch rubber, this fabric-covered 8-inch mouse pad delivers your mouse a very smooth ride. For only $9.95 plus $2.50 shipping and handling, your mouse pad will be rushed via USPS first-class mail. Simply click on the happy little mice and be directed to our ordering page. Hurry while this limited time offer lasts. It's Tennessee Birdwalk.